Simon, could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Simon Barraclough. I'm a space research engineer at UNSW in Canberra.
Welcome to the Space Show, Simon.
Thank you very much.
You've worked on a number of space systems in overseas and in the United Kingdom.
Yes, so I moved over to, from after graduating from RMIT Aerospace in 98, I moved over to the UK, initially Bristol and then later in Stevenage, which is about 50 kilometres north of London, to work for Airbus Defence and Space in our supporting of ESA missions. So the European Space Agency develops new missions. Of course, they can't build them themselves. They have to get contractors, and we were one of the main prime contractors for building missions for exploration and Earth observation.
And could you name some of the missions you were on and some of the salient points about them?
Yeah, I can do. Certainly, Envisat was the first one I worked on, which was a very large Earth observation spacecraft. What was interesting about that, when I first arrived in Bristol, I'd never seen a spacecraft before because, you know, there wasn't ones to see in Australia. And then I see into the clean room in Envisat, it's the size of a bus. And I go, nod my head, go, oh, that's interesting. And that became my benchmark for every other spacecraft. So whenever I saw the normal size spacecraft, I always go, a bit small, because I got used to the very large Envisat. But that's particularly interesting to me because later in my career at Airbus, I got involved in the space debris problem and the idea of capturing space debris and re-entering it for the items that may be a hazard. And to the European Space Agency, Envisat is a particular interest because it is 8 tons. It is defunct now, unfortunately. It died in 2012. And it's in an orbit shared by many Russian upper stages and various other bits of debris. And so there's a concern with Envisat that you may want to dispose of it in a way that's safe. So we got involved in the Harpoon activity to try and capture the a part of the structure and then tow it back into the South Pacific. So it was quite nice to start from the beginning of Envisat and look at, you know, working on the design and doing some analysis to the end where we're trying to actually work out how to capture it and dispose of it. So Envisat was quite interesting. But then after that, I worked on Beagle 2. So I did some thermal analysis for one of the payloads on that, which was exciting. And it was quite different from the thermal point of view because Mars is quite a different environment thermally. It's a little bit of air, but it's not enough to be useful, but it's also not enough to not worry about. And it's in that sort of annoying area. So a bit of analysis for that, for the Open University, working with Colin Pillinger on that one. But unfortunately, as we know, Beagle 2 didn't work. But the recent photo last year, and they found at least many of the solar arrays, except the last one, had deployed. So we're quite pleased that it looks like it made to the surface. It's just unfortunately one motor didn't deploy one panel, and the antenna, unfortunately, is under that panel. So it would seem that it did mostly work, which, you know, we were quite pleased about to see. So,
yeah, we on the Space Show have been using Blur's music that was supposed to be broadcast by Beagle 2 as our theme music for Mars.
Okay, yes. Long Distance Left to Run, I think it was called, or something like that. Beagle 2 and Colin Pillinger was very good at sort of doing this promotion and getting Blur involved, getting Damien Hirst involved for the colour calibration chart. And it was very clever at doing all that. And it was partly, it's why the mission succeeded, because it was a mission opportunity. ESA had a spare bit of mass. Said, all right, if you want to make a go of it, go for it. And, you know, Colin pulled all that together in a very short amount of time. So, yeah, it was a fun mission. Yeah, certainly. But after Beagle 2, it was Rosetta, as we talked about earlier, and then many other missions, AOLS, METOP, Solar Orbiter. So I was the lead thermal engineer for the design of Solar Orbiter, which in 2020 will go to an orbit that's very near the Sun. It's sort of an elliptical orbit that comes within Mercury's orbit. So that was interesting, trying to devise a configuration of spacecraft that would accommodate the 10 different payloads with very competing demands, while still protecting them from also the extreme solar environment, which is some 12 times stronger than we see here at Earth. So, yeah, nice bit of challenge. It was quite nice because I was involved in the very early days. So the configuration, how it looks and how everything we put together, and most of that I did on my couch at home. And now I see pictures here, but they've shown us all over, and I go, yeah, I remember that. I put that together. But, we'll see how it goes.
Were you able to use solar thermal protections? Obviously, big issue on that mission. Were you able to draw on the experience from the Messenger spacecraft and also the work on the yet-to-be-launched BepiColombo?
Yes, I mean, certainly BepiColombo, because we also work on that in Stevenage, but there were certain differences the way things work. BepiColombo is a little bit further back, but also it rotates its attitude with respect to Sun in any direction because it's focused on looking down at Mercury. So there was different approaches taken there. We instead used a heat shield that was developed by colleagues in Italy from another company, and they through an ESA technology development activity. And that heat shield, well, the trick with that was that it had to protect the spacecraft, obviously, from the high intense heat. but we have to have a lot of payloads that look through it because they have to obviously see the sun. And so there was a lot of effort applied to how do you get the feed-throughs for the payloads, the optics payloads, to work in this heat shield design. And so, yes, we certainly used experience in BEPI, but we had to come up with something, well, they had to come up with something that was a little bit different to what was done there.
And when are we looking towards the launch of the solar?
I believe either 2018 or 2020. I'm not entirely sure. I know they're still working on many aspects of the design, and it's a complex mission, so it takes time, unfortunately. All these missions do. So. Yeah.
And then you moved on to which project?
After that, I then became a bid and study manager for future programs. So these were basically ESA has a novel idea, a new mission they'd like to go on and do, and they have they do a few little studies, things called CDFs or concurrent design facility activities. But then they decide they need to actually get a contractor in to try and flesh out the design a bit more. So it's what we call a phase A study. So I was mainly involved in phase A study for the Phobos sample return. So I led the pre-phase A activity for that, where we were looking at going to Phobos, trying to pick up some rock, and then eventually returning it to Earth to land in Woomera in a capsule. So that was fascinating. You go through the whole system design for that, and it's a very complex mission. We had to work on a launch, had to deal with the constraints of a launch vehicle and choices we were limited to on that. Had to build a multi-stage spacecraft, design a multi-stage spacecraft. Had a transfer stage to get to Mars, an ability to get in orbit, eventually land, and then a return stage to bring back the capsule and bring it back. And with that, going to Mars and coming back especially is really difficult for mass. You use a lot of fuel. Basically, the spacecraft is just a rocket with legs on it. I mean, there's a lot of fuel in there. And so it was a lot of sort of work and trying to get mass down to try and meet the launch vehicle capability. So it was fascinating. And then with that, as I mentioned before, I was also leading the sort of Harpoon activities, looking at Harpoon designs for the MVSAT mission, as I said. And then eventually I came here a year ago. I moved here to UNSW in Canberra to work on, hopefully now, future programs or missions for the Australian interests. You know, build a spacecraft here in Australia, and hopefully we develop something greater here than it has been so far. So.
Yeah, well, what's been built here in Australia at the moment are a whole lot of CubeSats, which are quite a bit different from NVSAT.
Yes, it's only different, but they're all spacecraft. They all have to survive the same environment. They have to survive similar light launch conditions. They have to still communicate. They still have to generate power. Yes, they're smaller, but that's more of convenience of opportunity of launch. I mean, it's still fundamentally have to be a spacecraft that works. So you can take all that big spacecraft knowledge and apply it. Now, I agree, you can't do everything the big spacecraft do, but occasionally you don't have to, because CubeSats do have advantages in being small that they don't have the same need to verify certain things that the big guys need to do. But we can't sort of say they're completely different. They are just still spacecraft. So coming here and looking at that, to me, CubeSat or big spacecraft, yeah, spacecraft, and I'm a geek of spacecraft, and I'm happy with CubeSats as much as anything else. But hopefully Australia does get more involved in instruments, maybe on other programs, so if we could contribute to an international mission where we provide an instrument, that'd be great, and we'd certainly love to be doing that. Or maybe a slightly larger, maybe the 100-kilogram class spacecraft. I think Australia could have the capability to doing that. But we're never going to build the big telecom satellites, and we never should. That's handled by other people, and they've got much more money and much more capability. That's not something we need to compete in. But the smaller stuff, the stuff that answers Australia's needs in Earth resources and monitoring, or possibly even Australian interest in exploration, if Australian scientists want to support a mission where they think they can get good research that they can benefit their, or get good data that can benefit their research, and if we could provide a mission to do that, well, yeah, hopefully that happens.
So you don't subscribe to the idea that NBNCo bought a satellite from overseas, America, and Argentina on the same rocket had their own indigenously built satellite?
Yes, they certainly did, but they put a lot of money into it. And it's great they support this. I'm really glad they do. But I think currently the climate here is where it's a gradual, cautious approach, and I think that's correct, because people, it is a lot of money, and taxpayers want to know their money has been used appropriately, and that's fair enough, they should do. So if we work our way slowly through this and actually develop the capability and get the people in and the facilities to do this, yes, maybe we can get to that. But ramping straight up to a big spacecraft is dangerous, and I think we have to do it in a very careful, measured approach, so that we can create a sustainable system here, that we can actually build more and possibly export. I mean, there may be other customers overseas who would want our product, and that would be great if that was the case as well for this country. So,
So would you regard yourself as an optimist or a pessimist for the future of the Australian space industry?
Well, certainly optimist, otherwise I wouldn't have moved here. So, yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, okay, I moved here because of our families, me and my wife's family's here, and we want to be nearer them. But ultimately, I had a very good job at ESA, working with ESA at Airbus, and it was great. But there was, it looked like something more was happening here. It looks like momentum's building for something more here. So it's great to come across and try and be involved in that.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Simon.
No worries. Thank you very much.